It's now a great pleasure to have one of the greatest sax players of all time, Big J McNeely, joining me live on the show from Los Angeles. Big J.
Hey, how you doing?
How you doing there,
big guy? Fine.
It's good to have you on the show. Your records get requested all the time. The people love you.
Oh, great.
America still loves you, Big J McNeely.
Thank you, man. I love America.
So you're playing now. If people are out in the Los Angeles area, you have a club gig that runs every other Wednesday. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's at Bruno's. That's at Gardena and Figueroa. Mm-hmm. And it's out like in Carson City. It's really nice. And I'm working with a little trio there with Richard on piano and Tony on guitar and have Lex drums. It's a groove. I mean, we play everything. We do all the oldie but goodies, you know, everything. I mean, there's the fine musicians. And I just, when I'm in town, I just jam with a few guys, you know. But most of my work is in Europe, you know.
Mm. It's at the Blue Note, you said.
No, this is Bruno, B-R-U-N-O-S.
Bruno.
Yeah.
Okay, I got you. Now, it was this past Wednesday show?
Yeah, I worked there this past Wednesday. So
okay,
we'll
so
off.
2 weeks.
Yeah, I'll be off.
All right, well, there you go. If you're out in L.A., you're going to go catch a Big J McNeely play.
Yeah, it starts at 6, it's over around about 10. Mm.
Now, when you were growing up, what type of music? Were you listening to jazz?
Yeah, you know, I started off playing jazz. Sonny Chris and I in Hampton Halls, we had a little jazz band. That's when Charlie Parker came to Billy Burke's in Hollywood. They had Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Howard McGee, Teddy Edwards, Lucky Thompson, you know, and Wardell Gray, and all those guys, you know, North Jackets, you know, all them guys was in Los Angeles. And so we grew up, I grew up playing jazz. But then after a while, I got out of school, I wouldn't study, and then I had my first hit record as a soul, and from then on, I was branded as a soul man.
Yeah. Now, whenever I listen to your frantic records like 3D or Nervous Man Nervous, it's like you're blowing, you know, you're blowing a bebop sax.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what I said. I was very influenced by playing jazz, and I had a chance to study from a good teacher who played first chair at RKO Studios, and he taught that full vibrato at 100 with a big sound, you know. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, a lot of the guys used to say, yeah, he's playing one note, but they never criticized the sound or, you know, playing one note. You can play one note, but it's how you play the one note, you know, that create excitement, you know.
Exactly, exactly. And, of course, you put the showmanship into
it
as well.
Yeah, well, yeah, that was part of my thing, you know.
Well, that's one of the things that separates you from a lot of the guys of the time.
Yeah.
Is you were the whole package, the sound and the showman.
Yeah, it was really great. I remember, and now I have a wireless, you know, but at that time when I got put in jail, arrested in San Diego, I didn't have a wireless, you know, and so the outside, and the band couldn't hear me, you know, my brother and the other guy couldn't get out because it was so crowded, and the police off-duty came by and called the station. They came put me in jail because I was blowing my horn out of the street, you know. So the band was still playing. They said, well, man, where's this guy at, you know? And my brother came down and bailed me out.
I heard that story, but I want to know if this is true. So you get put in jail for playing the horn outside while the band is still playing inside.
Yeah, well, see, we was downtown San Diego, you know, and all the buildings were closed. So I guess this guy off duty thought, who this crazy guy playing his horn out in the street, you know, this time of night, you know? And he don't know what's going on, so he called, and it was a kid there from the Navy. They said, hey, man, this guy's working, man. In fact, the police told him in jail, too. They said, well, man, we got this call, so we got to take him down. So I went to the court the next day because I had to go out of town, you know, so I pleaded not guilty because I wanted to try to explain. The guy said, okay, you have to go to the court in the afternoon, so I pleaded guilty, and the guy said $50 fine, and he suspended it, but don't go out in the street no more. You know?
Yeah. But the way I heard the story is that the band kept playing until you got bailed out and could come back. Is that true? That's not true, right?
Well, the band kept on playing, and my brother had to go down and get me out of jail. So Hunter Hancock, you know,
old HH.
Yeah, wait. So he was an MC, and so they wanted to come down to the jailhouse. The guy said, "No, man, don't go down there, man. They probably never let him out."
Yeah, that's great. All right, so you grew up in Watts.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Watts.
And you were playing the clubs around Los Angeles.
Yeah, I played all. Oh yeah, I played all the clubs. Back when I was 16, I that's when I started playing my horn, you know. Mm-hmm. I said, hey, man, there has to be a better way to make a living than working 8 hours. So I picked up my brother's horn and started playing. And then, like when I was in high school, around 18, you know, I could play on the bandstand, but when intermission came, I had to walk outside, you know.
And because you were too young.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I played all the players. I played with Johnny Owens at the Bell House. It was a jam mm-hmm. there with him. Mm-hmm. And then, Sonny Chris and I, we had a band. We played The Last Word. That's when Central Avenue was the thing, you know. They had the Club Alabama was across the street, just like the Cotton Club in New York, and they had the Downbeat and The Last Word, and you had After Hours, everybody would go, like, to the basket rooms and play, and the Scat Man Carrettas and Slim Gaylord and all the guys would be there after hours and jamming. So we played all down First Street. You know, but anyway, we was young then because we had to change nights, graduation to get off because we were still working at the club at that time.
That's where I was exactly going with the question, is Central Avenue during the 40s and 50s. That must have been quite a place and quite a time.
Yeah, well, that's like, you know, all the movie stars used to come down there, Clark Gable and Dame Cagney, all the guys, because the Alabama had a course line and everything. It was just like the Cotton Club in New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they came down because they knew that's where it was happening.
Oh, yeah. That was it. Then they had in Watts at the Plantation, they had the big club out there where Billy Eckstein's big band would go out there, and Diz and Basie and all the guys, Duke and all the guys would play out there.
Wow, that's amazing. So you're playing the L.A. clubs. How did you come to the attention of Herman Lubinsky at Savoy Records?
It's a funny thing. It was a guy named Prince Dansel. I was knowing. He said, man, Big Day, you want a record? I said, yeah, you know. And so he happened to know this guy. So a little guy had a little record shop in Watts called Pete Kennard. He would go out and select his records because he didn't want to get stuck with records. He had a little record shop. And he gave me a record with Ben Miller with the drums, you know, with the introduction. Mm-hmm. And so I take it home, and I wrote the tune, Deacon's Hop. Mm-hmm. So we went in the studio, and Lubinsky came out, and came out to my house in a cab and sat down, and he asked me what was my name. I said, Cecil. He said, no. What's your nickname? I said, Jay. He said, Big Jay. In fact, he's the one who gave me the name. At that time, I was still small, wasn't it big, you know. So
you had to grow into your name, right?
Yeah, so we went in the studio, and he just said, yeah, keep blowing, man. So I just got this, man, for about a year and a half studying, very legit, you know, studying solfege, ear training, and all that stuff. But I just said, I forgot everything. I said, I'm just going to play soul, man.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a big hit for me. And I would have went on the road then, but bought an ally with Johnny Otis. He was saying, man, how these guys get you back there and get you signed all these contracts, steal all your money and everything. So, and they wanted my brother to go with me, but they said, no, you can't come. So I wouldn't go. My record was number one in the country. I didn't go.
So Johnny Otis kind of took you under his wing and kind of told you to watch out for these guys. They'll get you.
Yeah, well, Johnny, plus Bardue Ally, that's the one that discovered Ella Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. He was like with Johnny Otis, the manager. So he knew what was happening because he was from back east. So he knew how those guys operated. So it was good because, you know, you go out on the road, you get through bad, you come back, you owe everybody money, and you don't have any money. You got everybody on payroll. They charge you more money for your suit, your clothes, and the other. Yep. It's a mess, man.
Right. Well, let's hear the record that established you, 1948, on Savoy Records, Deacon's Hop.
Okay.
Thank you.
The record that started it all for Big J McNeely, who's joining me right now live via telephone from Los Angeles. Big J.
Yeah.
That's a groovy record, man.
And thank you.
I can't believe that was recorded 58 years ago.
Yeah, because I'm 79 now, you know.
Very young 79.
Yes.
You sound great.
Oh, thank you, man.
And you were telling me that the horn that you recorded using, the horn you used to record that record is actually in the Experience Music Museum up in Seattle.
Yes, it's up in Seattle. It's a 10-inch con saxophone, same type that the Lester Young played, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they offered me around a couple of thousand. I said, no, man, you got to be crazy. And so when he offered me 10 grand, I said, yeah, I'll take it. It's a great museum up there. In fact, I went there. I performed on at the opening. You know, they had James Brown and a whole lot of people there together for the opening. It's incredible. They had one room that's all the artists from this era, you know, like Cab Calloway, Lil Richard, Fats Domino, Wynonie Harris, all the guys. And then as you walk through the museum, as you're eating, you see all the on the video, the machine, and they came down to Los Angeles and shot a scene on me. Then when I went up there, they shot a scene, so they had my saxophone. And on the front, in fact, from Washington, you got that museum that we call what's the name of that?
Smithsonian?
Yeah, like my
American
saxophone.
History.
Yeah, my saxophone's on the front with Jimi Hendrix hat and guitar, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's really nice on the magazine there in Washington.
That's great. Now, speaking of your horn, you're very famous for some of your flamboyant horns, like the glow-in-the-dark saxophone.
Yeah.
And the fluorescent saxes.
Yeah, what happened, you know, I'll never forget, I was in Clarksville, Tennessee. We was doing a chilling circuit gig, and we was upstairs, and nobody responded to our music, you know. Man, I couldn't figure out what was happening. So after intermission, I didn't change clothes. So after intermission, I got on my knees, not having my lady on the floor, man. Man, everybody started screaming out. I said, man, let me try. So when I got to Fort Worth, Texas, I tried it great. So when I got out here, man, you know, all the Spanish kids and everybody, white kids, they went crazy, you know. And so then there was a lot of other artists who was copying my act, you know what I mean, walking and laying on the floor. So I said, man, I got to do something. I'm always thinking about what I could do, you know. So I was in a place called a Nightcap. It used to be a place after I was all the musicians go jam. And so I was like Atlantic Boulevard. And so this girl came out, a burlesque dancer in fluorescent. I said, that's it, man. So I went down, and I had the guy paint the horn. He'd never done it before. And you have to have the black light, you know?
Uh-huh, yep.
And so a lot of the musicians, and it was a transparent, so you couldn't tell, you know. You just thought maybe the shade of the horn. And the guys couldn't do it because they didn't, they know what was happening, you know. But when we did the movie for BBC and they did the history of black music, they had Charles Brown and his Mama Thornton, Joe Liggins, all of us, Johnny Otis, Huggy Boy. And it opened up in my apartment in the post office, and then when I was working in the post office then. And we ended up at Variety Fifth, and that's when my horn changes colors, you know, glows in the dark. And so after that, like I said, the guys up in Seattle, they wanted the horn, and so when they offered me 10 grand, I said, yeah, you got it, man. So it's up there.
So the horn they have up there is the fluorescent horn.
Yeah, the horn.
Right.
The actual horn that I did Deacon's Hour. See, first one I did. Yeah, I used to carry two horns.
Mm-hmm.
And it got difficult changing because I had to do my act. I changed. So I decided just to paint the keys. So now I just paint the keys and I use one horn. And then I decided to put on white gloves.
Yeah.
And so now when they turn out all the lights, all they see is
the
white gloves, the hands, and the horn.
And the keys.
Yeah, it's very, very effective.
That's great. So the whole playing on the floor thing started from not being able, the audience just wasn't with you, so you had to work it. You had to work the crowd.
There you go. And that's what happened, because I had no idea ever to lay on the floor, man. That was far from my mind.
Are you still laying on the floor?
Oh, yeah, occasionally, yeah. When I do these big shows, when I go to Germany, Australia, Japan, and I lay on the floor. I was doing a little thing out here, and somebody said, how you just lay on the floor? So I just laid on the floor for you.
there's that classic picture of you where you're on your back, and all the kids reaching for you are white kids.
Yeah. Well, so, see, I played the out here. I was playing like the 5,000 and 6,000 white kids a week, mm-hmm. and nobody knew it. I mean, because we was working, we'd go into theater like into a little small town, and man, would close the theater up at 12 o'clock, and we'd go in and pack the place, you know. And so we was working like the Orpheum downtown, and that was taking the wrestling arena at that one picture there. So my manager, that they wanted the band in San Diego, so my manager was Gene Norman, owned the Largo in Hollywood. And they called up, so we outdrew Ray Anthony and K-Star down there, and Capitol Records was there, so they went to see them when nobody there, so they came to see us, you know. And they wanted me to record with them, but Herb Lubinsky, you know how these record companies, they said, no way. But anyway, he bet his manager, hey, a big jail break up the show with Johnny Ray. And so, man, the guy said, you know, they know what was happening, you know. So I broke up the first show, and man, I said, if you don't stop it, we're going to stop the concert, you know. And I was supposed to go on the road with him, but they say, no way. Ray Anthony, Johnny Ray's manager said, no way would he go with us. And so that's when even Nat King Cole, you know, when we was real young, he came over because the drummer knew his first wife, Nadine. He came over and we sitting in the garage playing. He said, man, you guys keep it up. You'd be great, you know. But I worked a concert with him in Oakland, and he came out and we were screaming, man. And so he just came out with Too Young. He wanted to sing, man, but he couldn't sing. He had to play, man, you know, which uh-huh. is a great big musician.
Right, absolutely.
So he saw us in Bop City in San Francisco and said, man, you never work with me again, you know. So I thought he was playing, you know, but my manager knew his manager very well.
Uh-huh.
And I was supposed to go on tour with him and say, no way, man, you know. So sometimes it kind of hurts.
Yeah.
When you can't create excitement, you know, because they never know. You know, because like one time with Lionel Hampton, I was real young then. And, you know, Gladys, she always protect Hamp, you know. Nobody stole the show from Hamp.
Right,
you know.
Right.
We was at the Wrigley Field. You know, they used to give a big concert. They would march all down Central Avenue with the horses and everything, man. A big parade up to the
field? The,
yeah. So that time I had Jesse Bevan with me, you know what I'm saying. So Gladys, I guess somebody must have told her about me, you know, because she knows everything, you know. And so she called the promoter and said, pay him off. And so after Jesse Bevan got through, the man said, come down and pay him some money. So, but with Hamp called me up to do Flying Home with him.
Oh, wow.
And so what happened is, you know, like I said, I didn't have a wireless. And so as we were playing, my brother and I, we jumped off. We were right behind second base. So we went past third base. I went all up into the stadium. You know, that's what had Wrigley Field, had a little small ballpark there. And went up, and everybody, kids, go, hometown boy, you know. So when I got back on the bandstand, Hamp taking all his band and marched them off, the whole band, to home plate. And I moved to the second base. So I just got on my back and crawled all the way to first base on down the dugout. And Hamp followed me all down there. And so big thing in the paper the next day. Yeah, the Sentinel. That was the black magazine. I mean, newspaper, the Sentinel. And it says hometown boy steel show. Oh man, he was hot. And I never worked with him again after that. That was the only time I worked with him.
That's too bad. But you were playing Flying Home with him.
Yeah, but I was playing Flying Home.
So
with
you
him, yeah.
You were playing the Illinois Jacket part then.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a fantastic song. I wish there was a recording of that, man.
I do have one.
Of you playing?
With
Hampton?
It's done on a live album in Seattle, Washington. It's really good arrangement, too. I mean, the band is kicking, man.
That's great.
Yeah,
right.
I'll have to send that to you.
Yeah, I'd love to hear
that. Yeah, because we got a lot of stuff, like done live in Birdland, and that was in Seattle, Washington, but also we got some live Birdland in New York. I worked in New York in Birdland.
Sure.
And so Flying Home's on there, and some more tunes. Yeah.
Now you were you mentioned before about Jesse Bevan. I wanted to talk to you about when you assembled your vocal group, Three Dots and a Dash.
Yes.
How that came about? You just figure you wanted to branch out a little bit and get into the vocal songs a little.
Yeah. Well, Jesse and I were very, very good friends. You know, I was the first one to carry him on the road. His mother, you know, let him go with me. You know. And we went on the road. We was down there in Atlanta, Georgia. I can tell you some stories about Georgia.
Oh, I bet. You run into trouble in Georgia, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Guy, I'll never get to Savannah, Georgia. But anyway, you know, I knew Jesse. We grew up real great. He's a great guy. He'd give you coat off his back. I mean, he's a lovely guy. And so we just, a little kid named Jimmy Huff that was in there wrote this tune called All That Wine Gone. See, when I used to have all these shows out here, I had Spanish, I had like one white kid that sang like Frankie Lane. I had a saxophone, Spanish kid, saxophone player from Santiana. In fact, he's a cartoonist for Walt Disney in Florida now.
Oh, wow.
And so I had a lot of Spanish. I had a very mixed band, so that was to draw everybody. See, we used to go around and play all the high schools and everything. Then when they get do the session on the weekend, it would just be packed, you know. So what happened, they got to the point where the police started barring me out because they never, they couldn't understand why the kid was responding to the music because they never seen that before. Because, you know, at that time you had Frank Sinatra and Perry Como and all those guys, you know. And Hunter was the only station that was playing what they call race music at that time. That's why he was so big, you know, because you want to hear that type of music, you had to turn into to Hunter. And like we played out in Huntington Beach, and one guy wrote an article and said they had like 1,000 kids dancing like Watusis. <You know? laughs> And so they couldn't stop it. So what they did, they wouldn't give me a permit to play, because we did a thing at the Shrine Auditorium with Earl Bostic.
Yeah.
And Gene Norman had to get a special permit, man, for me to play, you know.
So they pulled your permit to get you to stop playing because you were mixing the races.
Yeah, that's it. They didn't understand. They'd come around shooting pictures. They thought they was high on drugs or something. You know, they didn't know because all the kids were responding. And they said, what is this, you know, because they never seen it before, you know. So they're shooting pictures and stuff, and police is coming. So they say, well, the only way we can do it, just stop the guy. But we won't give him no permit to play.
Well, when was that, early 50s?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So at that time, when your permit was pulled, is that about the time when Three Dots and a Dash got together?
Yeah.
When you hired Jesse to sing with you?
Yeah, I went with Imperial. See, first I thought it was Savoy, and then I went with Imperial.
Right.
To Imperial, and then I went to Lou Chud over to Imperial Records.
Yeah.
My booking agent knew him, and so that's when I started trying to branch out. And I do something different, you know, like with All That Wine Is Gone and some other things. And then now, I'm singing now, but I wasn't singing then, you know. I have some great tunes now that I'm doing this. Like, I got one tune called Mom. It's incredible vocal. But like my late stuff now is more, you know, it's kicking, man. Like,
yeah.
I did some things. I recorded with a couple of different bands in Germany, you know. And then I got a live album I did in Australia, and also one in Budapest. But like we did, I did Summertime in East Berlin, man. It's just awesome. Believe me, I'm going to send you some stuff so you
can.
It's awesome because, so I always like jazz, and I listen to my old stuff, you know, but I don't sound like 50, 60 years ago, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course. You've progressed over the years.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, because I always wanted to play jazz, but, I mean, I was doing the honking and the screaming and stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
But along with your great solo records, you know, and your great horn playing, you also have the distinction of being the guy to first put Jesse Belvin on record.
Yeah. I was the first one, like I said, I was the first one that came on the road because the mother wouldn't let him go with anyone else. But,
right.
You know, we were tight, so... she let him go on the road with me, you know.
So let's hear that record, All That Wine Is Gone, Jesse Belvin's first appearance on Wax, singing with your vocal group, Three Dots and a Dash.
Great.